Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Threats of higher tariffs are back. Challenges to Fed independence continue. A Q2 earnings season is about to begin, and U.S. equities seem resistant to it all. So joining us on this Monday morning to talk about all of these matters, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, the head of asset allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, it's great to have you back here on the program. I know we were off last week, though, as is always the case, a lot happening in markets, a lot top of mind for investors, all that we'll be covering during our conversation today. So nice to have you back with us, Jason.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here. Good to be back, I think. Hopefully markets are not completely chaotic in my return, but yeah, good to resume and pick up where we left off a couple of weeks ago.
Definitely. So perhaps we can talk about some developments from over the weekend, starting with tariff threats. President Trump did add to pressure on the U.S.'s main trading partners over the weekend, saying that he will levy a 30% tariff on imports from the European Union and Mexico. Now, this follows a threatened increase of tariffs to 35% on goods from Canada and 50% on copper last week. So what is CIO's latest thinking on tariffs, the trajectory there, Jason, after this latest round of threats?
Well, tariff demand is back. That's one thing is clear. Now, you can look at this from different lenses. In one perspective, you could say, well, this is negative. We thought we'd move past these reciprocal tariffs that were moving towards multiple deals, and they would have done by August or July 9th. The 90-day kind of ended 90-day reprieve from back in the Liberation Day tariffs in April. Instead, we get all these announcements of new tariffs. I think it's important to note that, you know, these deadlines have been extended, and this is for effective August 1st, not effective immediately, so, which means there still is almost 3 weeks to negotiate among the different countries towards some sort of deal to get them kind of back either lower or avoid it entirely. Ultimately, we do think that this is just still part of a negotiation tactic from Trump and the White House. And we maintain, this is CIO view overall, we maintain our base case that the U.S. effective tariff rate will ultimately settle around 15%. The question is, why is this happening? Well, on the one hand, you have market conditions that have believed in this, Trump sort of not following through the so-called taco trade where Trump always chickens out. The S&P, was up ultimately 6% the first half of the year at an all-time high. I can imagine that would certainly embolden the president to, kind of proceed because they've announced these other tariffs. We're not seeing it clearly in the economic data. The markets are behind, so why not willing to kind of push forward? So I think there's a little bit of, pushing the envelope, and given the economic and the market conditions in particular are amenable to that. It's also possible that negotiations with other countries behind the scenes are not progressing as well as the U.S. administration and Trump would like. I think there's a general agreement among both the market participants, investors, but also these other countries that the 10% universal tariff is probably like that's the baseline, that that's what the minimum that the Trump and team wants. And so there's no point in sort of trying to negotiate over that, but they don't want to go much higher, than that given the potential economic pain. So perhaps countries weren't willing to offer a lot of concessions because, well, why do we have to give up something we know for sure we're going to get this 10% universal tariff? If that's possibly what's happening, then kind of reminding these countries that these reciprocal tariffs are still possible, you have a few weeks to get them done and get deals done, that could be sort of one motivating factor. So this is sort of the dynamic and just sort of continuation of the story that's been going on really since Trump was inaugurated back in January. Ultimately, again, we think the base case hasn't really changed despite these headline noise. It may take a little bit longer for those tariffs to not be implemented, meaning perhaps we get to August 1st and some of these reciprocal tariffs actually go into place because countries believe that Trump won't keep them in place. And until the economic data really kind of shows weakness or the market to pull back again, you would need those conditions for them to ultimately kind of be walked back as part of some sort of deals as the economic pain becomes much more apparent, which is likely to happen just due to lag effects later in the summer. One other thing to kind of consider is that the tariffs are imposed under the IEEPA, the International Economic Emergencies Powers Act, that allows Trump to impose his 10% universal tariff. The Court of International Trade essentially ruled against them. It went to the Court of Appeals. They put a stay on this, meaning they can stay in place. On July 31st, the Court of Appeals was going to have hearings on these reciprocal tariffs. and whether the president can actually impose them. Ultimately, this is probably going to go to the Supreme Court, and they could decide later this year, early next year, and then there's a decent chance that ultimately this goes beyond what a president can do. So eventually those might come down and other tariffs could be put into place. So that is sort of in the background. Other countries might be thinking these court issues, could kind of work in their favor, further kind of complicating things as well. But ultimately, end state is, we don't think it's really changed despite all the tariff noise over the past week. And the market's sort of response is consistent with that.
We know these headlines continue to come in quickly, so it remains a fluid situation. We'll continue to track these developments as it relates to trade policy and tariffs. Another item to spend a few moments on, I know President Trump and members of his administration continue to press the Fed to cut rates, and they could use concerns about the Fed renovating its office building in Washington, D.C. as grounds for dismissing Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. Now, given all of these external pressures, what is a likely outcome, and what do you think the Fed is likely to do here?
Well, we know for a while that President Trump has been pressing Jay Powell, the Fed chair, to cut rates. He's tweeted about it. He's talked about, the Fed funds rate should be 200 basis points lower, like around 1%. He can say a lot of things, but obviously, the Fed will do what it thinks it's appropriate. This point about firing or getting rid of Powell, that's also been in the background. There's been some questions. Does the president have legal authority to do that? And there was a Supreme Court ruling recently, a month ago, where ultimately they concluded that, for very committed, departments, government departments, the president does have the authority, but explicitly sort of called out the Fed as a place where the custom and precedent suggests the president cannot fire the Fed chair without kind of undue cause, which is brings up this issue of regarding the renovation of the Fed building in D.C. It's costing upwards of $2 billion or maybe even more. It's been going on a while. That's not the reason why that there's some who'd argue that Powell should be fired. It's more that he did not or was not honest in congressional testimony about the costs or overruns. That's clearly an effort among members of the administration to look for different angles or ways in which to either fire Powell, create enough pressure that he's forced to resign, or just kind of undermine his credibility. And that's kind of the ongoing sort of dynamic. We'll persist. Now, whether they pursue that, the likelihood of that happening, that's more of a political question than it is a market or investing question per se. So I wouldn't put a probability on that overall. It does seem more likely, though, or what is relatively likely, is that by later in the summer, Trump will announce Powell's replacement. Now, the way it would work is that Powell is in the job until May, but there is an opening on the board that would become available in January. He can announce the only replacement for that seat, and basically designate that person as the Fed chair in waiting. In which case, you would have someone who is not actually a member of the Fed, but who'd be viewed as, this person effective next May, next June, will be the Fed chair. The markets won't pay attention to it, and that person can sort of jawbone the Fed towards cuts or giving guidance of how they would want to do things. The real question out of all this is, does the Fed sort of reaction function to incoming economic data and other policy developments? Is it changing in some way that would cause them to be more aggressive in cutting rates? Right now, we are assuming the Fed's going to cut rates starting in September, 50 to 75 basis points this year, contingent on just how the data evolves. But ultimately, whether they do 50 or 75 this year, 100 basis points by, kind of Q1 of next year. Market pricing has, 20% chance for the July meeting, which is at the end of the month. More like 2/3% probability for a September cut, but still upwards of 2 cuts by year end. But it's very much conditional on the economic data. The Fed is a pretty conservative organization. They don't change their approach very quickly. It's very kind of orthodox. So the idea that suddenly an external Fed shadow Fed chair who's not in power that could have influence and would cause the board, the FOMC specifically, the deaths of the policy rate to change path, seems quite unlikely. By the day, the Fed will follow the economic data. We get CPI data for June this week. Consensus expectations are about 25 basis points month over month, which is still relatively contained and not yet indicative of, the tariff, consequences of tariffs. So that could further fuel calls for the Fed to cut rates, given the June payrolls data was relatively strong versus kind of expectations, or at least kind of fears that it would start to kind of show a lot of weakness. There's justification for the Fed waiting until September to get a couple more months of data to see how the tariff impact is playing out. Also to see what these new tariffs that are being announced, they actually go into place, because that would have some implications for the Fed, how they will think about it. But all this noise and chatter about, you know, changing the Fed chair, wanting the Fed to cut, I think for the most part, the Fed is relatively immune, at least in the near term, to that pressure. But it's certainly there's not a zero risk that something more dramatic, you know, couldn't happen. But in terms of something near term, it's more likely the Fed stays the course. The president, you know, makes the Fed sort of the scapegoat. If things do deteriorate, they should have been cutting rates. It wasn't my policies, things of that sort. So there's a political reason and benefit to actually having Jay Powell stay in the job because he can become a political whipping horse for the president as well. So all things considered, I think it's more status quo for the Fed for the time being rather than dramatic changes, but we can't possibly rule them out entirely.
A very interesting dynamic in play involving the Fed and the White House. You did mention the CPI print this week, Jason. In addition to that, another point of interest on Tuesday of this week, July 15th, the unofficial commencement of the Q2 reporting season. We will be hearing from a number of the big banks reporting throughout the course of this week. Overall, what should investors expect to see during this earnings season?
Well, so the earnings season is, we'll be watching closely to see where are the signs of tariff impact. Q1 numbers, just for a reminder and context, end up being much better than expected. Q1 earnings for the S&P 500 grew 13% year over year. It was a 6% beat relative to expectations going in. So there was not a lot of impact of the tariffs, evident in Q1. But, tariffs did go into place at the beginning of April. There should be some signs of consequences there. Because of those tariffs being implemented, even though the reciprocal tariffs were paused, there still is 10% on, kind of across the board. There's some certain sector-specific, tariffs in place, like on steel and aluminum. Analysts were cutting their expectations. Since April, so overall expectations officially have been sort of tamped down by quite a bit. For the second quarter, on a year-over-year basis, we're looking at a consensus number of a little bit over 4% year-over-year, and now around 7% for the full kind of calendar year, this 2025 versus last year for earnings kind of growth. And that hasn't really changed very much. Now, we've actually seen in recent weeks some upside surprises for various companies, such as like Nike and Levi. This is probably maybe kept equity markets somewhat resilient, given investors, confidence that perhaps the numbers, at least for Q2, is still kind of coming relatively resiliently. There's been other positive revisions going into the earnings season. So the expectations are modest, and we know the kind of the game is such that if the consensus is expecting 4%, on average companies beat by about 3%, so we could actually get something closer to 7% in year-over-year growth in earnings for Q2. But this is sort of, I think kind of expected, and maybe the thought is that it could even be better than that, given, what's happened recently with the guidance and the revisions and the stronger Q1. And so it might be a little bit from the market perspective, the arrive versus destination, or the travel versus arrival, meaning markets kind of priced in sort of a relatively positive outcome. When we get it, it won't be sort of a less of a surprise, as opposed to for Q1, the numbers are coming in better. That was one of the factors and why the S&P was able to rebound, as strongly as it did back in April into May. So something that we'll watch closely. I think the markets are cautiously optimistic about a relatively decent earnings season, and looking for guidance about how companies are kind of managing, the tariff impact, especially now, though this will be looking forward. They can no longer rely on imports or front running the tariffs, back in Q1. Now this is going to have to be fully baked into their guidance. And the final thing I'll make is a weaker dollar, all else equals, actually positive for U.S. earnings, because foreign earnings then become more valuable in U.S. dollars. Tech companies in particular make a lot of money outside of the U.S., in the range of about 40% of their earnings. So it's quite possible we can see a very strong, quarter for, tech, for consumer discretion, kind of Mag 7 related companies as well. So the recent strong performance for those companies, that could continue, given some of the earnings numbers that come out in the coming weeks.
So, Jason, to recap thus far, you've covered for our listeners very near-term issues, have spoken about the Q2 reporting season, the August 1st deadline for reciprocal tariffs, though you also wrote in a recent blog, title is Don't Call It a Comeback, that the Roaring 20s scenario is still in play, the Roaring 20s regime, that is. So can you elaborate as to why you believe that's the case?
Well, if you think about where we were 6 months ago, coming to the start of the year, we're coming off of 2 years of very strong equity market performance. The S&P total return in 2023, 2024 was over 23% in both years. Cumulative total return in the first half of the decade, over 100%. We'd come off 2 years in a row where GDP growth was the compound average growth rate was around 2.85%, so very strong kind of growth rate. So the economy, by kind of the metrics we've been using to talk about a roaring 20s regime, was roaring. And more, I think investors are kind of coming around to kind of a view that, at least, relative to these metrics, this was the backdrop for the U.S. economy. Of course, that changed relatively early on in the year, especially after Liberation Day, the tariffs were announced. In the S&P, intraday was down nearly 20%. Back in mid-April, the concept of U.S. exceptionalism, certainly being challenged, if not being viewed outright, this is over. The idea that it'd be a roaring 20s regime, that seemed dead on arrival at that point in time. We fast forward another 3 months now, I think it's roughly at the midpoint of the year. It's just worth pointing out, in the first half, ultimately the total return for the S&P 500 was 6.2%. If you double that, you're at over 12%. That's a little bit higher than the 80-year historical average for the total return for the S&P 500. So kind of, an average normal year, in a year that certainly has not felt normal for the markets. But it also, to me, means maybe this roaring 20s regime that seemed, for dead, and perhaps this is there's still life to it. And ultimately, what I kind of wrote in the blog is that relative to the start of the year, the probability is lower, but not necessarily dramatically lower. And so for all the policy noise, some of the key secular trends are still largely in place. And the framework we've used, and we've talked about this multiple times on the podcast before, is that the possibility of a roaring 20s regime is ultimately predicated on a investment-led productivity boom that lifts potential growth, allows the economy to grow faster, closer to 3%, without being inflationary. So for this to happen, for it to be sustainable for multiple years, you really need kind of these positive aggregate supply side developments. Like, that was sort of the necessary condition. If you think about that, was kind of the start of the year, that was the kind of where we were. We had the Liberation Day, sort of tariff shock. Where are we right now from the supply picture? Well, on the positive side, AI adoption is rising. It's rising probably a little faster than maybe was even expected 6 months ago. Companies are beginning to use these AI agents in ways that could demonstrate the potential for higher productivity for the rest of this decade. There's a lot of questions like when we see the benefits. I think we're starting to see the benefits of AI. This could lift productivity growth, maybe not so much this year, but certainly within 2 to 3 years, like the rest of this decade, allowing that regime to be sustained. Now, less supportive on the supply side is that we haven't really seen a CapEx boom. We haven't seen sort of animal spirits, kind of being unleashed that some people thought post-election that would happen. And, policy uncertainty has been really elevated. Expectations for slowing growth, potentially recession, that's weighed on investment. Business confidence indicators are down since the start of the year. And it's really confidence more than anything else that's going to drive business investment. Now, some of that can change as a result of Trump policies, or Trump 2.0 policies. So passage of signing the One Big Beautiful Bill, it does provide some tax incentive to invest. If we can get some clarity in the next month or so on tariffs, that will help at least allow companies to sort of plan a little bit more and potentially invest more. Part of those tariff announcements and sort of setting the rates could also correspond to Trump announcing investments by companies or countries investing in the U.S. So we can kind of proclaim victories. Again, that would be a positive development. So there is reasons to think the policy situation should be more conducive to investment later this year and certainly into next year. But we wouldn't expect, and I don't expect animal spirits and a CapEx boom to materialize, except perhaps for all things AI. But what's also a little bit maybe different today versus 6 months ago is that there is maybe more scope for an aggregate demand story to kind of lift the kind of the regime back to where it was. The big beautiful bill does have a little bit of fiscal stimulus for next year. All else equal, adds anywhere from 30 to maybe 80 basis points of GDP growth. It depends on the different estimates. So that is a positive. You have the Fed that will, we expect to see start cutting rates. Financial conditions have already been easing. That provides some support. Going back to our Fed discussion about having some, the Fed cutting rates because of political pressure, there is certainly a risk that, the path of the Fed going forward is going to be a more accommodative monetary policy, all else equal. A part to deal with the fact that interest rates are high. You want to cut, not interest rates are high, but the deficit is large. You need to kind of pay for it. Having lower interest rates would, be beneficial. So ultimately, kind of get some form of financial pressure. Five is conditions that are more reflationary. So growth goes higher, but inflation stays elevated. There's even a risk of bubbles forming in this case versus a supply story that is more kind of benign. Your productivity growth can stay high and inflation can come down. So there's different sort of drivers, different dynamics, but relative to where we were in April 3 months ago, this roaring 20s regime persisting is certainly a higher probability, not as high as it was back in January. Last thing I'll say is I predicted last December as my finance word of the year for 2025 that roaring would be the term, but it would come from behind. The first half of the year would be dominated by Trump policies, taxes, tariffs, and that's been the case. But as the market kind of moves past that, as we go into year end, some of these roaring dynamics could come back. And, you know, I kind of use the analogy of a 1500 meter Olympic race. You know, you're back in the pack for the first few laps, and in the final lap, you kind of sprint ahead and at least either make a race of it, if not outright win. So I think the roaring 20s regime at the main point of the year is sort of in that position. It's not so far back that it can't kind of make a comeback, but it will require a lot of things to kind of go right. And I think we should not, you know, rule that out entirely.
So, Jason, if we take all of these factors into account, what is your market outlook at this time, and what should investors be doing with respect to portfolio positioning?
Well, just in terms of equity markets in particular, they've been very resilient despite a lot of the headline noise on tariffs. There could be some complacency there. You know, they're not cheap by any stretch. And so if we come to August 1st and deals haven't been done, tariffs go into place, the markets could pull back on that. I think they're relatively complacent on the economic data. You know, ultimately, we do think you're going to see inflation pick up and growth slow down. So some disappointment on the economic side, and it hasn't really happened in the past 2 months, certainly could cause the markets to pull back in the near term. But ultimately, we kind of think on a medium-term basis, the fundamental picture for the U.S. economy is still relatively constructive, and therefore, for next year, that's why we have a price target of 6,500 for on the S&P, you know, some more upside over that time period. How to play this, the tech sector is, you know, what we still like, you know, kind of the whole time to the AI theme, and I think, you know, 2Q earnings will give some guidance to that. Also, with 2Q earnings, you know, get financials reporting right away. Financials is a sector that we think is going to benefit from some of the macro conditions, but ultimately a lot of deregulation push, so a little more idiosyncratic. It's not specifically tied to the macro. Companies are able to unlock more capital, pay it back, increase your activities. So financials is another kind of preferred sector. We think rates, you know, can be choppy, but, you know, also have a decent chance they could back up again if economic conditions, you know, prove somewhat resilient. And if the Fed were to get aggressive and cutting rates, that lowers the front end, but the back end of the curve, the 10-year, the 30-year, can actually go higher on, you know, kind of inflation concerns persisting, you know, over time, which is also why to hedge all this gold remains, you know, a relatively attractive, you know, portfolio diversifier. So those are some of the kind of ideas. Medium term, constructive, near term, markets can melt up, but as they do, you know, there's a definite risk that during the summer we can get some pullback. We know that late summer, September, October historically is one of the more difficult times of the year. So something to kind of watch out as we move into later in the summer.
Jason, as always, appreciate the guidance when it comes to positioning as well as the clarity with respect to sharing your market outlook. And we touched on a lot of timely points of interest, top of mind for our listeners, our clients, all of which we will continue to track very closely. So thank you again, Jason, for beginning the week with us. And I look forward to picking back up with our conversation in the week ahead.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.